Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Now it is time to bring our forces home.
The United States will withdraw troops from Afghanistan and end its longest war by the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. But will there be another Taliban takeover? I talked to the man who oversaw the deadly raid on Osama bin Laden, retired Admiral William McRaven, author of the new book, The Hero Code. And you don't belong here. Former war correspondent Elizabeth Becker tells me how three female journalists defied the odds and rewrote the story of the Vietnam War. Plus,
aha, maybe, just maybe, this is a signal that there's a higher theory out there.
Has Einstein's dream finally come true? Physicist Michio Kaku tells our Walter Isaacson about a breakthrough scientific discovery and his new book, The God Equation.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Three U.S. presidents have tried and failed to end the war in Afghanistan. Joe Biden is refusing to be the fourth. By September, he will withdraw thousands of troops from the country, known as the Graveyard of Empires, and NATO is likely to follow. Today, Biden saying the 9/11 attacks are no justification to stay.
War in Afghanistan was never meant to be a multi-generational undertaking. We were attacked. We went to war with clear goals. We achieved those objectives. Bin Laden is dead, and al-Qaeda is degraded in Iraq and Afghanistan.
It's a campaign promise kept, but also a risky bet.
Precipitously withdrawing U.S. forces from Afghanistan is a grave mistake. It is a retreat in the face of an enemy that has not yet been vanquished, an abdication of American leadership. A reckless pullback like this would abandon our Afghan regional and our NATO partners in a shared fight against terrorists that we've not yet won. It will also specifically abandon the women of Afghanistan, whose individual freedoms and human rights will be imperiled.
The Taliban already threatening trouble if foreign forces don't leave by May 1st. That's the deadline that was reached by the former President Trump. And just yesterday, U.S. intelligence officials said prospects for a peace deal remain low, predicting the Taliban will make battlefield gains in the next year. But after speaking to Biden, the Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, said that his security and defense forces can defend their own nation. And President Biden is determined to press on. A source familiar with his thinking told me the president figures no amount of troops will be a game changer there anymore. So joining me now for perspective is the retired Admiral William McRaven, who commanded the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. He's also author of the new book, The Hero Code. Admiral McRaven, welcome to the program. So I mentioned Osama bin Laden. Let's just go back to the beginning. The only reason U.S. and NATO allied forces are in Afghanistan is because of the plot that Osama bin Laden hatched under the auspices of the Taliban on 9/11. Now, 20 years later, these troops will be gone, but conditions won't have been met. In other words, the long-standing demand that the U.S. see peace and political reconciliation there will not have been met. Just give me your vision of what this will mean on the ground.
Well, thanks, Christiane. You know, obviously, the Biden administration has made the assessment that we can't win this war militarily, that it's going to have, you know, some sort of political outcome in order for us to leave Afghanistan in a thoughtful, timely manner, which we are trying to do. But as you point out, we went there in the first place in order to take away the sanctuary for al-Qaeda. And if you look over the last 20 years, we have been successful in doing that. We have not had a major attack on the U.S. since 9/11, and certainly nothing from Afghanistan. So our mission, to some degree, we achieved the results we were hoping to achieve. Now, as the president looks at departing on September 11th, there are still going to be risks. And from my standpoint, as a former senior military officer, all you can hope for is that the president has listened to the advice and counsel of his senior leaders in the military. And I know for a fact that he has listened to General Scott Miller, who is the commander of the ISAF forces out there. He has listened to Frank McKenzie, who is the CENTCOM commander, of course, Chairman Mark Milley, and the Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, all four men who have had extensive experience in Afghanistan. And they have had the opportunity to present the risks, to present the challenges to the president. And really, from a military standpoint, that's all we can hope for. Then at the end of the day, we are a professional military. We will follow the orders of our civilian leaders, and we will do the best we can to execute those orders. And I think that's that is the way forward for us right now.
Let me just ask you to think back then to when the Obama administration, of course, Joe Biden was vice president then, withdrew all forces from Iraq. And shortly thereafter, ISIS came storming in and took over what we were told was a piece of land the size of France and the size of, I don't know, half of Western Europe. And it took many years and a redeployment of thousands of U.S. troops to rid that place of ISIS. Do you think that is a risk by leaving Afghanistan in this way now, whether it's ISIS or any other anti-Western terror group?
Yeah, well, obviously ISIS and Taliban aren't the same. But I know that the military leaders have learned from what happened in Iraq and the rise of ISIS. They have briefed the president on, again, the risks of do the Taliban come in back into power, what is going to happen in terms of the sanctuaries, what will happen to the progress that we have made with the women in Afghanistan. I am confident that all of those risks have been laid out in great detail to the president, and part of the president's assessment was, how are we going to mitigate those risks? You know, the Taliban have never been an existential threat to the United States. It was the sanctuary that they provided for al-Qaeda that was the threat to the United States and our national security. So moving forward, the question's going to be, can we minimize those risks when we depart Afghanistan? Can we continue to kind of keep an eye on the threat that may emanate from Afghanistan? And I am confident that military leaders, if they are given this challenge of figuring out how we're going to mitigate the sanctuary and or take away the sanctuary and mitigate the threat, that they will be able to do that. They will be able to ensure that we have drone coverage and intelligence assets on the ground. We'll figure out a way to do that.
Okay, so that's what my question was going to be. How do you figure it out? You say drones and some intelligence assets. Is that enough? And I guess the second question to that, and you've been, you know, a commander of forces on the ground when you were in combat there, commander of special operations. I mean, you're intimately, militarily and intelligence-wise connected to Afghanistan. Why is it that the U.S. intelligence community then has, as the president is announcing the withdrawal, says that it is likely that there won't be a peace deal, that the Taliban will continue to make gains and could possibly overrun the elected U.S.-backed Afghan government? What has happened in these intervening 20 years that has allowed that to be the case? And conversely, why aren't the Afghan security forces, after everything the U.S. and others have done, able to stand up?
Well, I mean, if you listen to President Ghani, they are. I mean, we have trained, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of 350,000 Afghan national security forces. Now, the question is going to be, will they be able to stand up to the Taliban? And my expectation, Christian, is that, you know, again, the military leadership has thought through this with the Afghans, that they are putting, they are putting things in place to ensure that we can provide a quick reaction to the Afghans if they need it, that we can provide close air support if the Afghans were to continue to need it. So our job will be to mitigate the risks that are going to be posed by this withdrawal. And make no mistake about it, I'm not here telling you that there are no risks. There are risks, absolutely. What I am telling you is I think the President of the United States understands those risks, that he has probably given the task to the military and the intelligence community to figure out a way to mitigate those risks. We will have to do so from the neighborhood, I'm sure. And, you know, I've got to believe that there may have to be some very small residual presence on the ground in Bagram or elsewhere to be able to facilitate our resources coming in and helping the Afghans when they need it.
Ooh, well, that would be interesting. We'll see if the president plans to leave, as you say, a residual force. Let me ask you, you mentioned...
I'm talking about, you know, a small amount of people to help facilitate things. I'm not talking about hundreds or thousands of
Well, soldiers. There aren't hundreds of thousands now, Admiral. There's like 2,500 U.S.
No,
and
hundreds
maybe...
or thousands.
Yeah, okay.
So my point is, you know, a handful of people on the ground in Bagram to work with the Afghans and to kind of facilitate things that'll be necessary for our support.
I get it. The president, Ashraf Ghani, has spoken to President Biden. He has said he respects the U.S. decision and that he believes his forces can defend their nation. But, of course, we see the U.S. intelligence and others, U.S. military on the ground, have reported a very severe uptick in Taliban military activity on the ground, gaining more territory, more civilians killed over the last year than previously, the same old business as usual. This is what the president told me about life in Afghanistan and how they didn't want just any U.S. withdrawal. They wanted to be, you know, prepared to maintain the gains that you all have fought for. Here's what he told me.
One thing needs to be clear. Afghan society is not willing to go back, and we are not a type of society that the Taliban type approach of the past can be imposed on us. That was the peace of the graveyard. We want a positive peace where all of us together overcome our past, embrace each other, and together rebuild in Afghanistan that can be what I call a roundabout, where all civilizations, all people, all activities can interact.
Admiral McGraven, that was the president, along with the First Lady, who was very concerned about what happened to women in Afghanistan, because your presence has given women the ability to, you know, have their rights in Afghanistan, which are under great threat right now. I want to ask you, from your experience with the Taliban, what do you expect? I know the president and those who are talking about, you know, the reasons for withdrawal are saying that, well, the Taliban, even if they do, you know, have some military victory, even if they do take control, will not want to be an international pariah again. Do you think that? I mean, they're already saying, you know, women have to stay where they belong in the house. They don't want to go to Istanbul, which is an attempt to have a summit, to have a political resolution. They haven't met any of their commitments to the Trump administration in the peace negotiations that the U.S. has been backing. What do you think, from your gut and your experience, the Taliban will do if they are victorious?
Yeah, I do not trust the Taliban at all. Never did and never will. And the fact of the matter is, I think they are going to try to come back into power. I think they are going to try to establish a pre-9/11, if you will, presence. So the question is going to be, once again, how are we going to deal with that? Well, it is going to be up to the Afghans. And, you know, when your culture and your society and the remarkable men and women in Afghanistan are threatened, I hope they will step up and fight hard for the gains that they have made over the last 20 years. I believe the president of Afghanistan when he says what kind of future he can see for it. But I got to tell you, it's going to be a fight. Once again, I hope we are in a position to help our Afghan allies if the Taliban begins to make this move. That is, again, remains up to the President of the United States to determine how much military power and how much military presence he wants to continue to provide to the Afghans, even if it is from kind of over the horizon, if you will. But again, nobody should be naive to the fact that the Taliban will try to return to a pre-9/11 position. Our case, of course, is how do we prevent Afghanistan from becoming a sanctuary for terrorists? I think we can do that even without a full-time, you know, 2,500 men presence in Afghanistan.
And what about the Afghans who put their life on the line to help the United States to, you know, infiltrate? You know that better than anybody, because I'm sure you had many there helping you. Let me just read what journalist and author George Packer has written today about this in The Atlantic. He says the Biden administration has given itself almost 5 months. That's enough time to save Afghans who risked everything to help the United States in their country. But that isn't enough time to save them just by speeding up the review of visa applications. These Afghans have to be extricated from the country and taken to an overseas U.S. military base where their cases can be heard in safety beyond the reach of the Taliban. Given what happened to Iraqis who put their lives on the line to help the United States, and many of them were abandoned to their fate after the pullouts, do you agree with Packer's take? Are you concerned about what happens to those people? Every villager knows who they are. And if the Taliban comes knocking on their door, they're not going to have any mercy.
Yeah, I do agree we need to take great care of those Afghans that went out of the way to help us in our fight in Afghanistan. These were some remarkable patriots with incredible courage. And so I agree with Packer's assessment that we need to do something. Now, I'd have to unpack the details of it. You know, can we move them to another base to adjudicate their needs about getting to the United States or finding sanctuary elsewhere? I don't know about the details. What I can tell you, Christian, is, you know, we have an obligation to these men and women who helped us. And I think that obligation is, you know, almost as important as our obligation to the troops, the U.S. troops and our allies who are there. They were our allies, and we need to find a way to help them.
Well, those are very strong words of endorsement from you, and I do hope that they are listened to, because those people have nowhere to go, and they helped for 20 years to do everything they could to help the United States,
and
help their
they
country.
Helped and they died in that cause.
Yes.
And again, we have a moral obligation to help these people, those that helped us.
Indeed. Can I ask you about your book, of course, the Hero Code? So you talk about a lot of elements of character, I guess, that inspire heroism. But you also talk in context of your experience as a commander in Afghanistan. And I want to pull one of these paragraphs, one of the excerpts. You talk candidly about a tragic accident that you were involved in. Soldiers from my unit had surrounded the old man's compound, hoping to capture a local Taliban leader. Two of the man's sons, seeing soldiers on their roof, but thinking they were Taliban, tried to defend themselves. The Americans fired at the men, assuming they were enemy sympathizers, and the two sons were killed in the fight. The old man's daughter and two other women were also killed when one soldier's errant rounds went through a door and struck them. You have described that as one of the most gut-wrenching episodes that you faced on the ground. Talk to us a little bit about that, but also in the context of what we've known. I mean, I've covered Afghanistan for years, and we've seen the unacceptable level of civilian deaths, often mistaken, we're told, for terrorist groups and organizations. But that has been a sort of an unhappy badge of much of the U.S. experience there. Tell us about what went wrong.
Yeah, what I will tell you, Christian, is that, you know, every American soldier out there did everything they could to minimize civilian casualties. You know, when we had a mission from our special operations unit, you know, we had, 100 people kind of watching, trying to make sure that we reduced civilian casualties to zero. The guys on the ground did everything they could to protect the innocent civilians that were there. You know, war rarely turns out like you would hope it would. And this was the point of that story. This, I will tell you, was one of the most tragic events, not just in my time in Afghanistan, in my life. And I grappled with how to approach it. But I realized that I had to go apologize to the father for this inadvertent and horrible accident that occurred. And I remember talking to my counterpart that was with me at my command, General Salim, an Afghan, and I was asking him, you know, how am I going to do this? What do I say to the old man? How can he forgive me? And General Salim said, well, he will forgive you, just kind of matter-of-factly. And I said, I don't understand. How can he forgive me and my soldiers? He said, he will forgive you because it will take the burden off him as well. It will not only relieve your burden, it will relieve his burden. Well, frankly, I had a little trouble believing that until I went down and I apologized, a heartfelt apology to the old man. And I tell you, it crushed me looking in his eyes, realizing that he had lost his children. And the old man forgave me. And the point of the story was, you know, of all of the noble qualities that I talk about, and that's what heroism is. We admire our heroes because of their noble qualities. Of all the 10 qualities that I lay out, Forgiveness, I think, is the most important. And today, you know, society, people in society are very easily aggrieved today. You know, the least little slight we take offense to, and we hang on to the anger, and we hang on to this power we think we have over the people that slighted us because we want some sort of retribution. But the real heroes are the ones like that father. The real hero are the ones like the families from the Emmanuel Church in South Carolina that forgave Dylan Roof some of these unforgivable acts. Man, if they can forgive, can't we find a way to forgive the small slights and maybe even the larger slights that come our way every day? I think if we did that, we'd find ourselves a better society and better people. So it is about forgiveness.
And that is the heart of your hero code. Admiral William McRaven, thank you so much for joining us this day. Now, as the United States gears up to leave Afghanistan, Afghans are bracing for what could lie ahead, as we've just been discussing. And that might be a resurgent Taliban. CNN has exclusive video from the Taliban stronghold of Musa Qala, giving a rare glimpse into what life is really like there. And correspondent Nick Patton-Walsh reports.
Now America is leaving Afghanistan. After nearly two decades of blood and treasure lost, what world does the US leave behind for ordinary Afghans? Taliban stronghold Musa Qala is where many American and British soldiers died. Now, it's a snapshot of how the Taliban will run Afghanistan. We asked six men living there, two on camera, anonymously, in safety, what it's like. In short, bleak for women, a few smartphones, but for all, Taliban justice and Taliban taxes.
There are consequences if you don't pay, they beat you or imprison you.
A broadly medieval society then, considering all the billions spent, except just recently with the odd smartphone allowed. That's how we got pictures of the streets. Taliban roam the market US Marines once patrolled 10 years ago. The Americans were based here, a location you can see on these satellite images, not far from the empty shop where the Taliban have their temporary courts, which they call The Room, dispensing swift, brutal justice.
Punishments depend on what the other side wants. If the plaintiff forgives a murderer, the court might not give a death sentence. But if the relatives demand it, they may. For example, around 4 years back, three thieves were hanged to death from the electricity pole on the road out of town for people to see. They had been arrested a few times for robbery, but they did not stop.
This footage from a drive around town heads out to the refugee camps by the river from where US Marines used to get shot at, and it's clear few women are allowed on the streets. They still don't go to school. Nobody even dares ask about that, we're told. But most men we asked said women had it good. This is what they meant.
They are not allowed to do business outside their house. When they go out, they need to dress according to Sharia law. So for them, it's more important to take care of their homes than working outside.
Women can also get a rough justice in this backward world.
One woman pleaded guilty for adultery and she has been imprisoned for the last 5 years now. No one knows what will happen to her in the end. The man caught with her was killed by his in-laws for bringing shame to his marriage.
Fighting is rare here now, and the Americans must just watch from jets or drones above. In fact, we were told the Taliban only allowed some smartphones in Musa Qala because peace talks meant that US airstrikes there had slowed down. The Americans had been using smartphones to track Taliban fighters. Taliban rule in these streets means they set taxes from opium harvests or shops, we were told, or ask for bread or clothes for their fighters when in need. But some said feuds between Taliban groups mean people can pay more than once.
Many people have been taken to the Taliban room, locked up for a night or two, or have been beaten up. There are different groups of Taliban. It would be better to have a single authorized official getting tax, but every group tries to take tax for their own pockets. That's one problem for people now.
Life then goes on, much as it did before the Taliban were removed from power after 9/11, with just a lot of Americans and Afghans lost in the battle in between.
Nick Payton-Walsh reporting there on so many of the gains that may be at risk. Now, as a first-term senator in the 1970s, Joe Biden opposed another long-running conflict that cost Americans blood and treasure, and that was the Vietnam War. At the time, women were considered unfit for war reporting. But three female journalists pushed their way to the front lines and opened doors for generations of women that followed, myself included. The story of Kate Webb, Catherine Leroy, and Frances Fitzgerald has long been overlooked. Elizabeth Becker, a former war correspondent herself, is author of You Don't Belong Here, How Three Women Rewrote the Story of War. And now Elizabeth Becker is joining me. Welcome to the program, Elizabeth Becker. What an amazing book.
Thank
and
you.
What an amazing story. Before I get to that, I just wonder what you think and whether you see any deja vu, so to speak, because you were there, too, during the Vietnam War. You know how long it took. I mean, apparently half the time of the Afghan War. But again, a war that wasn't won and a war that the U.S. had to pull out of with all the trouble mm-hmm. that the civilians faced thereafter.
Just listening to your previous interview, I got chills because the mission kept changing. The civilian casualties were so horrific, and we had no idea what would happen. Of course, the surprise was how horrible it was in Cambodia, but you're right. There's too much deja vu.
And we'll wait to see, you know, what happens and whether, you know, in 2021, somehow you can mitigate, you know, I guess what they lost in Vietnam. But anyway, really, really important that you've written this book. So where did you take the title from, You Don't Belong Here? Let's take first things first.
Thank you. Directly from what happened to the women, most often to the French photojournalist Catherine Leroy. She was courageous beyond belief. She was at first belittled, considered impossible to become a photographer. So when she started to succeed, her colleagues, all male, thought that she shouldn't be there and told her quite blankly, you don't belong here. And this was part of the culture. These were photojournalists who we now really admire. But women did not belong on the battlefield. And they went to the length of trying to get her removed. Through a Freedom of Information Act request, I was able to retrieve her military record, where I saw how journalists and some of the military pressmen actually got her press credentials removed because, quote, she didn't belong there as a woman.
Well, she got them back, and you recount how she
yes.
just, you know, just like, for want of a better word, bulldozed her way into getting back
yes.
her press credentials.
Yes.
And the photos she
yes.
took were amazing, including one that at the time we hadn't seen, or America hadn't seen, a soldier in anguish at, or a medic
yes.
really, at the killing of one of the GIs. She was, today you would call it slut-shamed. She was accused
yes.
of having all these affairs. Her work wasn't taken seriously. As we know, she got her press card back when it was removed from her. But what was her contribution to the war coverage? What might we not have known had she not been there on the front line?
Well, she took real-life pictures of the soldiers and the civilians. And so you would not have known just the human cost and the human anguish. And no one less than Horst Voss, the great head of Associated Press Photography, said he hadn't seen photographs as good as Catherine since World War II. She courageously decided that the only way to tell the war story was to get as close to the eyes as possible, which in battlefield, as you know, Christiane, is crazy courageous. So the famous one of her taking the series of the medic trying to revive a dying soldier, she captured the anguish, she captured the anger and the sadness, and she resisted any attempt for heroic poses. So you caught a real sense of what in modern times is regular photography, real life photography, of the moment photography that really had been missing in Vietnam.
And you talk about you called her Frankie, I think, but Frances Fitzgerald,
yes,
who you mentioned her book, Fire in the Lake, yes, seminal book on the Vietnam War. And yet even all these many years later, you know, people don't put it in the bibliography. People, mostly men, tend to, you know, to shunt it aside. And of course, we all know about Neil Sheehan. We know about David Halberstam. We know about Peter Arnett and all those heroic, you know, male reporters.
Mm-hmm.
But the women really did distinguish themselves, and often they were there before.
Yes. And it wasn't as if they weren't recognized at the moment, because, for instance, Katrine won awards for her work as well as Kate and Frankie. But at the moment during the war, they tried to keep a low profile because they knew they were breaking new ground. And I remember when I got to the war, Kate Webb told me not to complain about the way women were treated, to try to keep everything as quiet as possible, because you never know, the military might tell us to get off of the battlefield again, all sorts of things. So in a way, that was part of the problem, that they wanted to be able to succeed. They loved covering the war. They loved the excitement and the purposefulness of the war. And they felt the best way to continue was to be quiet.
Which is extraordinary when you think about today, when nobody is being quiet anymore. But it did take a long time. I mean, you know, it took, yes, a long time, even for my generation. You know, we're not going to necessarily, back then when we started, upset the apple cart. Now the generations can do that if they see things that are unfair.
Yes.
But can I ask you, because I hadn't realized that actually there were rules that prevented women from being in combat or near combat. And you say in the book that these women particularly, and others who went to the front lines, they actually had to pay for themselves and get up and go on their own. They weren't deployed necessarily by their bosses.
Oh my goodness, they didn't even have bosses. They had no careers. They bought one-way tickets to Saigon. They had to hope that they could find freelance work. They had no editors back in the United States or Australia or Europe telling them what they wanted or what they couldn't do. And they lived hand to mouth for a long time. And they had no health insurance. They had nothing. So that makes their accomplishments even more amazing. And in the middle of all that, they convinced the Pentagon to let them continue to cover the war, even though there was an official ban against it. And that's what made it possible for you and Christiane and everyone afterwards. They never put the ban back on.
And believe me, I am very, very aware of all the women who paved the road for me, and I pay tribute to them. And I'm so pleased that we can talk to you about it, actually. But can I ask you, because you had a distinguished career out there yourself, you were there in the 70s, you went to Cambodia as well, but you also had your own Me Too moment, if I can put it like that. And you went there as a way to escape some very unpleasant predatory behavior. Just talk about your journey to being a war correspondent.
Well, I was in graduate school at the University of Washington, and I'd studied Southeast Asia in undergraduate and graduate. And then my master's thesis was rejected by the man who also wanted to bed me. And he said there was no connection between the two. And I wasn't quite that naive. So I decided that I wasn't going to let this man, he had just ruined my academic career, but I'd have to figure out a new life. And as it turned out, another woman named Silvana Foa, who I'd met in India when we were both traveling students, she had gone to Southeast Asia to cover the war, and she had been trying to get me to go out and visit her. So I went out, foolishly thinking that, oh, this must be the way things work. And Silvana made sure Kate Webb met me at the airport, so I got at the right plane in Hong Kong. I got to Cambodia, and I realized what a fool I was. It was so hard. It was so difficult. But at the same time, it was the most amazing thing I'd ever done. It changed my life, and I became a reporter. And just as a side note, my friend Silvana was kicked out of the country a few months later after I arrived because she had written an investigation of how the U.S. Embassy was illegally directing the bombers over Cambodia. This was the saturation bombing period. And 1 week later, that got her thrown out. And 1 week later, a New York Times reporter, Sidney Schamburg, wrote essentially the same story and nothing happened to him. And that was sort of the first lesson I had, that women were not going to be treated differently than men. But the appetite was such for news that within a few months, I was the Washington Post local stringer and Newsweek. And that's how it went. And then many, many years later, because of my work in during the war and going back when Pol Pot was in power, I testified at the Khmer Rouge Genocide Tribunal. And it was during that trial, bringing up all those memories and what we women went through, that I decided in 2015, I had to write this book.
And we're so glad you did. I mean, the idea of you interviewing Pol Pot gives, you know, sends chills up my spine. And that you went and testified is amazing. Elizabeth Becker, it's a wonderful book. You don't belong here, but of course, you do belong here. We all belong here. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Christiane.
And now, is everything we know about the laws of the universe about to change? Physicists are over the moon about the discovery that a tiny particle is behaving in a way that nobody could have predicted. It means that there may be a new theory of nature out there yet to be discovered. It's a complicated matter, but for theoretical physicist Michio Kaku, it is truly thrilling. Kaku is the author of The God Equation, and here he is with our Walter Isaacson explaining this potentially groundbreaking find.
Dr. Michio Kaku, welcome to the show.
Glad to be on. A real honor.
Well, so we have some big news, which doesn't always happen in physics, or maybe I should say some really, really tiny news that doesn't always happen in physics, which is we've just discovered that something called the beauty quark just doesn't disintegrate the way it should in the standard model, which is what we call the model of particles we have. What just happened? What does that mean?
Well, this could be a game changer. All of a sudden, scientists around the world are focusing in on this because we want to find the Holy Grail. That is a theory that would unify all the subatomic particles that we find. And we've had this standard model for 50 years. We've been stuck with a model, the standard model, that's rather ugly, with 36 quarks and antiquarks, three generations of identical particles, 20 free parameters. Could this be God's ultimate theory? Now, for the first time in 50 years, we found a deviation. And so people are saying, aha, maybe, just maybe, this is a signal that there's a higher theory out there, a theory of everything that would unify all the laws of nature, just the way that Einstein had hoped back in the 1950s.
Well, this standard model you talk about, which has all of these particles that, you know, are weird looking, is like a dog's breakfast. I mean, it's just really ugly. Einstein once, you know, when he had a theory, he'd say, is this the way God would have done it? It's supposed to be beautiful. Do you think the standard model will ever hold?
Well, the standard model is a theory so ugly that only a mother could love it. And even its creators admit that no. This is just a step in the right direction. And that's why this new result is so tantalizing, because it signals new particles, new interactions, and we need a new paradigm to unify all these things. And of course, I have some skin in the game myself. I'm betting that we're going to see evidence of a string, another higher evidence, a higher octave, a higher musical note of a tiny, tiny vibrating string. This, of course, is not experimentally verified, but this result coming out of Fermilab Chicago, the Large Hadron Collider outside Geneva, Switzerland, could be the signal that, yes, there is a higher theory out there, just the way that Einstein envisioned.
And when Einstein died, his blackboard still had scribblings. He had a book. And you were 8 years old and you read the newspaper article. Tell me how that set you on your journey.
Yeah, when I was 8 years old, something happened which completely changed my life and my destiny. a great scientist had died. All the newspapers showed a picture of his desk, just his desk, with the unfinished manuscript of his great theories. So the caption said, the greatest scientist of our time could not finish that book. So I said to myself, wow, why couldn't he finish that book? Why didn't he ask his mother? Why didn't he simply look it up in the library? It was a homework problem, right? Well, I went to the library and I found out this man was Albert Einstein. And that book was to be the final theory of physics, an equation no more than perhaps 1 inch long that would allow us to, quote, read the mind of God. Well, I was hooked. I had to know what was in that book, the unified field theory. And so I dedicated my life. In fact, I work on something called string theory, which we think is the leading candidate for this theory, that vibrations of a tiny, tiny string give you all the subatomic particles that we try to catalog with the Large Hadron Collider, with all the atom smashers that we have around the world.
Well, let me ask you about that string theory that you've been working on. It seems to me that that implies that there's not just one universe, but probably parallel universes, multiple universes. Is that true? And how many are there?
Well, yeah, this is a controversial prediction of string theory. But you see, our universe is a bubble of some sort. We live on the skin of the bubble, and the bubble's expanding. And that picture comes from Einstein's general relativity theory. String theory says we go one step farther. If it's a quantum theory, there are other quantum universes out there in a bubble bath. Think of a bubble bath of universes. When universes bump into each other or they fission in half, that's the Big Bang. So this theory actually takes us before the Big Bang, that there are other universes out there predicted by the quantum theory. And then, of course, people always ask me this question on email. Is Elvis Presley still alive in another parallel universe? Well, you can't rule out, you know, the king could be belting out hits in another parallel universe. But this is a controversial theory, and one day we hope to even test some of the most outrageous consequences of this theory. Maybe wormholes, maybe gateways to other universes, maybe other dimensions. These are all predictions of string theory that really, like, blow your mind away.
The universe we calculate began almost 14 billion years ago. When you get this theory, do you think it will be able to tell us what happened before the universe began?
I think so. The gravity wave detectors are the big news. Nobel Prizes have been given to these people. We're going to put the next generation in outer space. The satellite is called LISA, Laser Interferometry Space Antenna. It's three satellites, 3 million miles across, connected by laser beams, and it will get baby pictures. Baby pictures of the infant universe as it emerges from the womb 1 trillionth of a second after the Big Bang. And then the hope is we'll be able to have baby pictures of the infant universe emerging from the womb. And then perhaps, just perhaps, we'll find evidence of an umbilical cord connecting our infant universe to a mother universe. That, of course, is speculation, but that's where string theory is taking us. The fact that there could be a universe before the Big Bang.
And what about wormholes that might take us to other universes? How would they work?
Well, in 1935, with his student Nathan Rosen, Einstein wrote an article about wormholes, gateways, passageways between these bubbles. So think of two universes being two plates with a tunnel connecting them. And Einstein said, yes, that is a solution of his equations. We call them wormholes. And Stephen Hawking has said that perhaps one day an advanced civilization will use these wormholes to travel faster than the speed of light. And so using general relativity, Einstein himself introduced the concept of what are called multiply connected spaces. Think of Alice's looking glass. The looking glass connects Oxford countryside with Wonderland and the Mad Hatter. That is a wormhole, the looking glass of Alice, which is a solution of Einstein's equations. Today, we call them Einstein-Rosen bridges in honor of his famous paper of 1935.
And if we could travel through these and maybe travel faster than the speed of light, could we time travel?
Well, Hawking spent a lot of time looking at that question. His conclusion was that gateways through space traveling faster than the speed of light is compatible with general relativity in the quantum theory. Time travel, he was a little bit fuzzy about time travel. But you see, he thought that when you enter a time machine, maybe the time machine blows up. But that means you have a divergence or an infinity in your equations. String theory has no infinities. So I think that if time travel is possible and you go backwards in time, the river of time splits into two rivers. You see, time is a river. Einstein says the river can speed up, can slow down. The new wrinkle in all of this is that maybe the river of Einstein can split and fork into two rivers. In which case, if you save Abraham Lincoln from being assassinated, you save somebody else's Abraham Lincoln. Your Abraham Lincoln was assassinated at the Ford Theater. Sorry about that. You cannot change your own past, but maybe you can change another quantum past of another parallel fork in the road.
You speak of Stephen Hawking. In your book, you talk about meeting him, being there. Tell me what it was like to be with him and what you learned.
Yes, he invited me to give a talk on string theory in Cambridge. And visiting his house, I was amazed that there were all these devices, machines, that would allow him to do research. You put a journal in a machine, you push a button, and the machine turns the pages. You did not have to turn the pages of a journal. You just put the journal there, and the machine turns the pages for you. And I realized, what willpower. This person was paralyzed, and yet he was devoted to the idea of completing Einstein's dream of unifying the quantum theory with general relativity. That is sheer determination and willpower to wield a paralyzed body to complete Einstein's dream.
I'm looking at the background behind you, which is a galaxy, and there are points of light, and then the rest of the universe is dark. Now, if there are stars all over the universe, and it goes on almost indefinitely, why is not the sky totally light?
Well, that is Olber's paradox, and even Johann Kepler, hundreds of years ago, pondered this question of why is the sky dark at night rather than white. By the way, the person who figured it out was Edgar Allan Poe, the mystery writer. He was an amateur astronomer, believe it or not. He knew about this paradox of if there's an infinite number of stars, there's an infinite amount of light, and therefore the sky should be white and your eyes should melt because there's so many stars out there. Edgar Allan Poe said, the reason why the sky is black is because sunlight, starlight, eventually terminates. There was a beginning. You cannot go backwards infinitely into the past. There's a cutoff, and that cutoff we call today the Big Bang. And so think about it. I think about it when I take a shower. When I take a shower at night, just by pure thought, you can prove that the universe had to have a beginning. That is astounding that by pure thought, you know there has to be a finite amount of light or else your eyeball would melt, which means the universe had a beginning.
And what is beyond the edge of the universe?
Well, the universe is probably, and I don't know for sure, probably a bubble of some sort. It is so huge, it looks flat. We're like an insect on a gigantic bubble. And so the bubble, of course, is expanding, we think, into hyperspace. And so what is beyond the bubble? Well, the bubble would repeat itself. In other words, the farthest object in the universe could be the back of your head. And if I had a super telescope and could somehow peer into the greatest reaches of the universe, I would see the back of your head and the fact that maybe you didn't comb your hair and that's why your hair is all messed up. But again, we don't know for sure. Some people think the universe is infinite, but I personally think the universe is a bubble of some sort.
If we had a theory of everything, I guess in theory that would predict everything. Everything would be determined by the mathematics of that theory. Would that eliminate the possibility of free will?
Well, I think quantum mechanics does incorporate probabilities and uncertainties, so we'll always have that. But this theory, I think, will do something more. It'll predict to you what happened before the Big Bang. Was there a multiverse? It'll predict for you the other side of a black hole. Is there a white hole? A white hole on the other side of a black hole. It would tell you what dark matter is, which we think is the next resonance, the next octave up from ordinary matter. Time travel. It'll say, it'll determine once and for all whether time travel is mathematically consistent. And wormholes. Wormholes are actually very important because physics predicts that trillions of years from now, the universe must die. Physics is a death warrant for the universe because of the second law of thermodynamics, which says that everything falls apart, everything eventually dies. Except there's one loophole to this death of the universe, and that is the Einstein-Rosen bridge, a gateway. So perhaps one day when the universe gets super cold, everything is black holes and neutron stars, we'll build a dimensional lifeboat, a lifeboat, and leave our dying universe to enter a warmer universe, and then we can mess up that universe as well. We'll have two universes to mess up at that point.
For those in our audience who aren't physicists and following what's happening at super colliders, what is the ramifications of getting towards a theory of everything? Would that change our lives in any way?
Well, people ask that question. Once you figure everything out, how's it going to affect numero uno? I mean, me. Well, in the short term, it's not going to affect anyone at all. Because we are talking about universes. Each solution of string theory is an entire universe. But it'll answer some of the deepest philosophical, religious, physics question of all time. What happened before creation? Did the universe come from nothing, or was there a design? Are there other universes, parallel universes? What about other dimensions? And what about black holes? Is there a white hole at the other end of the black hole so that everything spews in and everything spews out the other end? And is that the Big Bang? Is the Big Bang a white hole? You see, none of these questions can be answered even using Einstein's theory. We need a higher theory. A higher theory to answer the final question, why are we here? Why do we have something rather than nothing? Why do we have this gorgeous chess game? And one day, I think we will become grandmasters of this cosmic chess game.
Let me ask you a personal question. This incredibly complex and elegant design of the universe expressed in mathematical laws, does that lead you to believe there's a cosmic designer or a creator, or what you might call God?
Well, I believe in the God of Einstein, not the personal God that answers prayers and at Christmas time gives you that bicycle that you've always wanted, but the God of Spinoza, the God of beauty, harmony, simplicity, elegance. You know, the universe didn't have to be this way. It could have been ugly, it could have been random, it could have been incoherent, but on one sheet of paper, you can write all the known equations of the theory of almost everything. Think about that. It didn't have to be that way. One sheet of paper with all the fundamental laws of the universe, which are quite ugly. That's why we want a higher theory. But the very fact that we can do that, to write a theory of almost everything, indicates that it just wasn't a sheer accident. Einstein thought that he was like a little boy opening the door of a library, and there was this huge library of books, and all he could do was open the first book and perhaps read the first chapter. But it was an ocean of books in this library. So that's the way I look at it, that it wasn't totally random. It wasn't chaotic. That in some sense, yes, the universe has a design.
Dr. Michio Kaku, thank you so very much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure and a great honor. And your biography is just marvelous of Einstein. It's one of the finest biographies I have ever read.
Well, thank you, sir. And thank you for joining us.
Some serious metaphysics to ponder there. And finally tonight, has anyone seen Darius? No, not my son, who's also named Darius, but the world's longest rabbit, measuring over 4 foot. In case you missed it, he hopped to the top of the Guinness World Records in 2010, but sadly, the giant continental bunny was stolen from his enclosure in Worcestershire, England, this weekend. It's a local whodunit, and his owner, Annette Edwards, is offering a reward of nearly $3,000 for his safe return. Hair-raising stuff indeed. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
You can now watch CNN's Five Things on Max. Each weekday, Kate Baldwin breaks down the five essential news stories in 5 minutes or less. She'll get you up to speed and on with your day. CNN's Five Things with Kate Baldwin, streaming weekdays exclusively on Max.